day and welcome to the city-hosted Opportunity Zone webinar. Today's webinar is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the webinar over to Mark Dean. Please go ahead.
Hey, thank you, Leanne. Good morning to our friends on the West Coast. Good afternoon to those on the East Coast. Welcome to another installment of City Community Capital's Market Insights. We've been doing this for a little over 3 years now. I'm Mark Dean. I'm the National Production Manager for City Community Capital for the debt platform. Many of you know City Community Capital is a leader in providing economic capital for affordable housing for a wide range of debt and equity products, construction lending, perm lending, Fannie Freddie, and then also our activities in the low-income housing tax credits. We think we're an important capital partner as it relates to economic capital, but we also think we're an important capital partner relative to intellectual capital. And intellectual capital can be as important or even more important than economic capital. So we've been running these webinars and sessions throughout the years to provide you an opportunity to increase your knowledge and awareness of important developments in predominantly the affordable housing business, but this is even greater in terms of the real estate business. Our audience today is that's assembled consists of developers, for-profit, not-for-profit, governmental entities, probably some state HFAs and local HFAs, LIHTC providers, syndicators, direct investors. It's a great cross-section of the affordable housing space. And so we're delighted. We consider ourselves thought leaders. We're delighted to be able to bring this sort of knowledge to our clients. So without further ado, I'm going to go into a little bit of the mechanics, and then we'll take a look at the poll, and then we'll cover through the agenda and get going. So there we go. First of all, to ask a question, we have two ways of asking questions during the webinar. If you have a question that you want to get it, get out immediately, you can email it to askcitycommunitycapital@city.com. Then also at the end of the webinar, we will have an audience Q&A, and the lines will be opened. Leanne will remind everybody of the instructions, but you press 1 and the operator opens your line and you be queued for the question. Additionally, this will be recorded and available within about 24 hours on our City Community Capital website, which the address is included in the presentation, or you can just Google City Community Capital. Also would like to mention that with our panelists today, there's a couple of additional resources available. The Novogradac Opportunity Zones Resource Center with a website, and then Sherman and Sterling, their website and information about Opportunity Zones. So I'm going to start with a little bit of maybe coverage or talking about who's on the call today. We have this poll that hopefully a number of you completed prior to the webinar joining, and it's kind of intended to give us an idea of who the audience is and perhaps what their level of knowledge is on the subject matter. So the first question is, you know, how are you involved in the real estate development business? And it looked like we have a great number of respondents. 81 out of 351 were for-profit developers. Other, and then no answer. So again, good cross-section. About 20 not-for-profit developers too. So good representation from the development community. Charlene, my poll just disappeared on me. I don't know if you can pull that back up.
Are you back?
I'm here, but I don't see the poll results again.
Shoot.
I did happen to take a look at the next question, which is, what is your level of knowledge on opportunity zones? I think the majority, in excess of two-thirds of the respondents, were just starting the investigation into how opportunity zones may impact or work in their business. And I think that's, I think that's a big chunk of where the industry is. One of the nice things about having the subject matter experts that we're going to have today is hopefully we can advance you and your business along that path of figuring out how to utilize opportunity zones. And then I didn't look at the third question, Charlie, and I don't know if you can see it, but when do you expect to close a qualified opportunity zone fund?
Yes, and I am showing that we had many are either sometime in 2019, and most are just uncertain at this point.
Yep, so I think people, again, are in fact finding to understand how this fits into their business. And then the last question was just, again, curiosity from the panelist about what asset class you might expect to use in an qualified opportunity zone fund. Can't see the results, but I'm going to speculate since a big chunk of our audience is in the affordable housing space, but there was some heavy emphasis there. But Charlene, what were the results on that question?
Very high emphasis on the affordable, both with GP interest and LIHTC limited partners interest. We had a few that are non-real estate and a couple more that are thinking about other commercial real estate.
Great. Thank you. So moving to the agenda, I'm going to take a moment here and just quickly introduce the panelists. Then we're going to have a background and kind of current status on opportunity zones. We've curated some questions to stimulate and facilitate discussion with the panelists, and then we'll have an audience Q&A open at the end. A couple of things. For those of you who have participated in these in the past, they generally run 45 to 60 minutes. We've extended the time frame for this. We suspect it will run something more along 75 minutes. So certainly, stay on as long as you'd like and as long as you find value. I suspect we'll have a fair amount of Q&A. And if it might be very easy to get in the weeds, and one of my jobs and the prerogative of the moderator is to help pull us back into the mainstream if we get too far into the weeds. So don't take offense with that. We do want to, as I mentioned, there was a way to email questions in. If for any reason we don't have sufficient time to answer your questions, our panelists have very generously agreed to post the webinar answer questions. So you just email it in, and we'll work with the panelists to get a collective response to you. So making sure everybody has an opportunity to, get their question asked and hopefully answered. So let's talk about who the panelists are. We have a great, great group of individuals today that are subject matter experts on this. The first panelist is John Hepplett, who is Managing Director with City Community Capital, co-head of the organization, and the most knowledgeable person within our group on opportunity zones. We have Lisa Brill, who is a partner with Sherman & Sterling. Going to be bringing a legal perspective to this. Jeff Jaeger with Standard Companies is a principal, and excited to have Jeff on because Jeff will be bringing the perspective that I think a lot of you are interested in is, from a development standpoint, a sponsor standpoint, how might these be used? And then last but certainly not least, we are pleased to have Mike Novogradic from Novogradic & Company on. And, between the four of these individuals, I don't think we could have a more knowledgeable base on what's developed and occurred so far on opportunity zones. That is a segue for me to hand over the webinar to John Hepplett to kind of give a recap of what's transpired and what we know in opportunity zones. John?
All right. Thank you, Mark. Charlene, do we have the presentation up and going? Good, we do. So I appreciate in the introduction, Mark, you said I'm the person most knowledgeable at Citi, but I think that's like being the best ice hockey player in Ecuador, and the other people on the phone on our panel are the Knights and the Capitals. So I'll do my best to get out of the way, but I think bringing more of a neophyte's perspective is to distill, my goal briefly, is to distill down at a high level what opportunity zones are, where the benefits are, so that we don't get lost in a lot of weeds and detail. There is a lot of complexity, legal structure, tax structure, accounting that we could get into. So I'm going to try to keep it high level. So as part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, there was the creation of opportunity zones. And at this point, the state governors, and actually it's includes the territories, have designated, I think, almost 9,000 opportunity zones across the country. Generally, they follow the low-income communities definition under the New Market Tax Credit section of the code, which, generally speaking, is focusing on 80% AMI communities. But it's a subsector of that. It is roughly 25% of such census tracts within a given state or territory, or a minimum of 25 census tracts. We will provide, I'm sure that will be a question, we will provide this material to everyone after the call, and there is a link there where you can find the exact census tracts, all 8,000-9,000 of them. This first slide, again, you will have this because it is a bit of an alphabet soup, but the key definitions for our purposes right now are that we expect people to invest in qualified opportunity funds that are invested in qualified opportunity zone businesses and business property. An important distinction we'll get up front, because it's a key thing for people on this phone, I think, is that with this Act's intent of rebuilding left-behind communities with long-term capital, creating new businesses that will hopefully stimulate meaningful change, that word new business is something to focus on a little bit, because creating a new real estate development is a new business. Buying an existing asset is not. And that's a lot. Some people have ahead of this time asked, you know, why does it have to be such a substantial, you know, 100% rehab? That's because there's a goal here of making it a new business. And so you put a lot of money into a shell, it's a new business. If you buy an existing business of any kind or flowing real estate asset, that's not considered a new business for this purpose. For the next slide, please, Charlene. Again, distilling this to the critical things, there are three benefits of opportunity funds, and so we're going to keep using these words very specifically to refer to the three different benefits. There's a deferral benefit of taxes, a reduction of taxes benefit, and a future elimination of taxes benefit. Now, the first two are where they come about is the concept of you take a prior investment with a capital gain. Our little flow chart example is a $500 investment you made a long time ago. Realize that this year, or within the, within the 180 days preceding the creation of your qualified opportunity fund, and had that $100 gain, a corporate, let's just go there for now, a corporate taxpayer would owe 21% tax on that gain this year. By putting the $100 gain, not the $500 original investment, not the $600 that you realize from that investment, but the $100 gain into a qualified opportunity fund, you do not owe taxes, the $21 of taxes this year. It is deferred. So that's the first benefit, the deferral. It is deferred to the earlier of the disposition of the fund, or 2026. So for most purposes, we're talking about an 8-year deferral of taxes, which is valuable in many ways. You know, it's effectively leveraged to you. And so there's a value to deferral of taxes. In addition, there's a reduction. So that $21 of tax on a $100 gain that you're not paying this year, you're paying in 8 years, you actually get to pay less than $21 of taxes. It steps down 10% at 5 years and to 15% at 7 years. But again, for this audience, we're mostly in a long-term hold position, possibly the 15-year tax credit period, for example. And hence, it's really you would expect that for this group generally, we'll speak about getting the full 15% reduction
of that taxation on gain, in this example, $18 in 2026 instead of $21 today. So those are the first two benefits, deferral of your original taxation on your original gain and reduction of that tax on your original gain. Now, the third benefit, and the value of each of these different benefits varies by investment, the type of investment and the performance, obviously, is the elimination of future gain, of taxes on future gains in the Qualified Opportunity Fund. So if you hold this Qualified Opportunity Fund for at least 10 years, you will never pay taxes on the gain from that, in our example, $100 investment. Potentially a very meaningful benefit, but again, it's consistent with the objective of the program to get long-term investment in underserved communities. Okay, next slide, please, Charlene. Speaking specifically to the affordable housing industry, there are obviously two places where these benefits can be realized. One is in the GP interest, and certainly that we have examples in our industry where there is meaningful equity in a transaction, but let's even just think about more typical affordable housing transaction where there's a gap, there's no sponsor equity apart from developer fees, but there's no, you know, true conventional equity in the transaction. You could still set up a qualified opportunity fund with a de minimis amount of gain from some other prior investment, so hence, obviously, the deferral of taxation on that de minimis gain and the reduction of taxation on that de minimis gain is de minimis. However, this sets you up for elimination of any taxes on future exit from that property, presumably after 10 years. Could be at year 15, could be longer. I know many of our clients are long-term holders. It's useful to note the similarities and differences of this to a 1031 exchange at exit. And we can talk about that after, but notably, it is a permanent elimination of taxes. It's not just rolling it, and it doesn't have the timing requirements. So we have, crossing over into the conventional space more, heard about people doing a 1031 into a QOF. I'm sure our experts on the line could delve into that more, the practicality, either later or at a future date. Second, in the affordable housing, the LP interest on the tax credit side, same thing, deferral, reduction, and elimination. Depending on the structure, the main benefit there may be deferral and reduction. So tax credits are 15-year investments, so you do expect to get the 8-year deferral and the 15% reduction. And that can have a meaningful benefit to the project. I think we'll talk about market reaction, but I'll just even put it up here up front, is at least in theory, a 15% reduction for a 21% corporate taxpayer without the deferral would probably be worth a few cents. And so you could get, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 cent, maybe, improvement in tax credit pricing. It's theoretical. Obviously, there are costs that come off that to set up these funds, but there is potentially, every cent counts in the LIHTC space, we know, and so there is a potential for increased LIHTC pricing to the extent that this goes forward. Finally, as always, there's a long list of considerations and unknowns, and this is where we start to defer to the true experts on the call. I think many of these we will find paths forward either through IRS guidance or practice and legal thought, in particular, whether it's a security or not. That last point, it always scares people when you see that something might be a security. Practical elements such as, and some of which apply more to non-long-term affordable housing, But if you have investments in qualified opportunity fund and they're realized before the 5, 7, 10 year period, is there the capability to immediately roll it into other qualified property for the fund without triggering the gain? And some other nuances, you know, whether you have to sell the qualified opportunity fund or whether selling the underlying property. I bring all this up in just a vague sense to give you the message that it is not yet all worked out, but I think we are moving rapidly towards the ability of the industry to start to adopt this structure. I'll just, before I hand it back to you, Mark, I will finally just note that I think this is a great time to be talking about opportunity zones. I think it came out quietly out of the tax reform because there were a lot of bigger, more pressing factors at that time. But the momentum is building. Here at Citi, in our municipal business, we're starting to get lots of questions from local governments, from developers, many clients, and it really drove home for me personally when I was at a grad school reunion a couple of weeks ago. Somebody didn't even know what I did, and they started telling me about one of their real estate investments and how there's this new tax thing that they're going to try to put it into. Sure enough, not only was it a Section 8 property, but he was dabbling in qualified opportunity funds. So it is spreading. A lot of interest, and there are potentially significant benefits. So back to you, Mark.
Great. Thank you, John. And I'll remind people that, again, this webinar and the handouts will be available on our website so that if you're feverishly taking notes, you'll also have an opportunity to have the actual deck. So that's available on the website. So John's kind of taken us from the known, and we're going to make a transition perhaps into the unknown. As he said, there's a lot of considerations, there's a lot of unknowns. So the next part of our discussion is we curated, less than a dozen questions that were intended to facilitate a dialogue amongst our panelists. And again, this is I'll refer to it as a virtual roundtable. While they're not sitting in the same room, they're sitting around the table, and we expect to have kind of different perspectives and opinions from each one of them, and share their thoughts on these curated questions. And then after that, we will actually go into some audience Q&A. So I get the pleasure of starting this discussion with, and this is actually, I think, a question I came up with because it happened. I heard a rumor that that Treasury doesn't intend to issue further guidance on opportunity zones. What do we know about that, and what do we know about future guidance? And I will maybe start with Mike Novogradic on that question.
Great. Thank you, Mark, and thanks for hosting this webinar, and I appreciate the opportunity to be involved in it. I wanted to maybe start by saying you can invest in qualified opportunity funds now. The program is up and active. I called it a program, but Treasury is a little nervous about that. They prefer to call it an incentive, but it is active. All the zones have been identified, and the IRS has provided guidance that says opportunity funds will be self-certifying. We need additional guidance to know how they go about self-certifying, but they are able to be formed, and we have some clients that have already formed qualified opportunity funds. Now, on the guidance front, the statute itself has a whole host of questions embedded in it. There are clearly ways in which to use the incentive now, what I call debt sort of down the middle of the fairway. However, there are a number of questions that we do need answers to. Some are more important than others. Treasury recognizes that there is a need for the questions to be answered, but Treasury also doesn't move quickly. Initially, we weren't sure what type of guidance they were going to provide. Now it's pretty clear that they're taking an initial approach of providing FAQs, or frequently asked questions, and they have answers to frequently asked questions. There's a website that they have that has these answers. And we expect over the summer there to be more announcements through this website on FAQs that will provide a number of operational sorts of answers to a lot of the questions we have. Just last Friday, they came out and clarified that if you had a gain from the end of 2017 and you invested in a qualified opportunity fund within 180 days, you could defer that gain. So that's the types of questions that they'll be dealing with, sort of one-off, two-off, three-off on their FAQ website. I'd encourage folks to check it out periodically. In terms of additional guidance, the more authoritative guidance, because that website, as others on the call will note, specifically says you can't rely on it in a court of law. So you do rely on it at your own peril, but it is the IRS saying what it is, how it is the IRS is interpreting it. We do expect more formalized guidance towards the end of the year, maybe November, December, but Treasury officials are encouraging the investing community to invest now and not wait for guidance, albeit your tax advisors aren't necessarily going to encourage you to be investing in certain ways until there is guidance.
Great. Thank you, Mike. Other panelists have any thoughts or additional information on that?
Yeah, hi, this is Lisa Brill from Sherman & Sterling. Thank you for hosting and happy to be here to participate. I would echo what Mike said. Some of my partners here and I have had some preliminary conversations with Treasury about some of the questions that were mentioned, how there are some ambiguities, and they've been happy to answer them and discuss them and have indicated that they are trying to formulate answers. They understand that there is some ambiguity. So some of the feedback we got was that there might not be answers on everything, and so some of the ambiguity will probably still remain. But certainly there are a number of professionals out there, in particular law firms and accounting firms, who are going to Treasury with additional questions, with interpretations, and trying to get that guidance. The feedback we've received is to expect, some over the summer, and, you know, they understand that people are actively trying to participate in the program.
Great. Thank you, Lisa. The next question, I think, is probably on the minds of a lot of people on this call, which is, hey, I have a project tied up that's in a qualified opportunity zone. How soon could a qualified opportunity zone fund be set up, and what will it cost? And that maybe sounds like it might be a good question, Lisa, for you to lead off with.
Yeah, happy to. So the first thing is, if you have a project that you think is in an opportunity zone, is when was it acquired? Because there's a key date in the regs that basically says, you know, acquired after December 31st, 2017. So that doesn't mean that you can't get the benefit of that property being in an opportunity zone, but it might need to be transferred to an unrelated party, which we could get into more detail in order to do that. In terms of how quickly you can set up a qualified opportunity fund, you know, it's the same as setting up any partnership or corporation. You know, you form it and it's set up. Clearly, it's, you know, an entity where there's going to be negotiation among the partners and things like that. But in terms of setting it up, as Mike said, it's self-certification. There doesn't appear to be any specific cost with that, any registration fee or anything like that. So it's really no different from setting up any other investment vehicle that you might use for the investment in property.
Great. Thank you.
And, Mark, I would just sort of follow up by noting that many clients will end up having captive qualified opportunity funds. And a captive fund would simply be, I form a partnership, in all likelihood, a partnership, and I have gained within the last 180 days. I fund the opportunity fund with that cash from the gain that I've recognized within the last 180 days. And then I have a period of time for that opportunity fund to either buy, you know, qualified opportunity business property, qualified opportunity zone business property, or invest in a qualified opportunity zone business. But you will see these captive opportunity funds that various clients own, and then they'll have their various measuring, which we can maybe go into later, the various measuring requirements. But it's something that we have a number of clients setting up now, even if they don't quite know where they want to invest the funds. they just know they have a gain. They'll fund it now. They'll wait and see if they're going to something's going to materialize because the 180-day clock is ticking.
Great. Thank you, Mike. I guess maybe just a follow-up question on this, without naming names or proprietary information, but, I mean, to the panelists, have you guys heard and seen Opportunity Zone funds that have been established, and have there been acquisitions that you've seen already?
I'm happy to start with that. So we have not seen any funds established yet, but there certainly has been a lot of interest, especially from developers and from people who actually own property in a qualified opportunity zone. But since there are a number of ambiguities, and since finding an investor who has a sufficient amount of gain, it's sort of tricky getting all the pieces put together, we haven't seen anyone who has actually invested yet in the underlying property. But certainly, as was just mentioned, there is a lot of pre-work going on. People who are taking the first steps to identify properties, to try to identify investors, to determine if the ambiguities in the law, and there are a couple of them, are such that it's prohibitive to do this now and it's worth waiting a little bit longer. Though certainly since we are expecting initial guidance over the next couple of months, people are actively trying to set up the structures and bring the pieces together.
And just to follow up, as I mentioned before, we have clients that have formed opportunity funds. They've invested cash in opportunity funds. And since they're recently formed, there's a reasonable argument that they have at least 6 months to invest that capital in qualifying opportunity zone property. And they're now waiting and looking. I'm not aware of any clients that have actually went to that last step of investing that capital, but they're getting themselves they've done all but that, and they're actively searching out the right type of investment, the right type of structure, hoping to get some guidance from Treasury over the summer in advance of closing on the investment side. And we do have at least one client that is out there actively raising capital from third-party investors. So it's not simply captive funds. There is at least one that client of ours that is out there raising capital from third-party investors.
Great. Mark, I was going to ask Jeff to get your perspective here, because obviously you deal with ambiguity every day of your life, and so I'd be curious what your thoughts are here.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't seen a lot of people that have proactively, because of the guidance, been pushing capital into the space yet. I think a lot of, and what Mike is alluding to, we've seen a lot of people that are reacting to the fact that they've had capital gains. That was triggered at the end of last year. This was something that came along surprise on the tax bill, and everybody's kind of, as a tax strategy, preparing whether it's captive captive funds or, looking at their options to be able to, redeploy that capital in a tax-free manner. And then at the same time, we've seen really on the brokerage side a huge activity from brokers that are starting. I'm not sure there's a full understanding of exactly what it means from a value standpoint, but the terms are out there and people are starting to talk about it. We have not seen anybody that is, actively pushing capital into the space yet. And we'll get into, obviously some of the ambiguities, but I'm not sure it's really possible yet to, kind of fully go into a capital raising mode and be able to, kind of deliver certain, promises to investors as to, what's available.
Hey, Jeff, have you seen or experienced that this mechanism might affect, I think you said brokers are keyed in on it. Do you think this impacts pricing?
There's really two different sects. I think the first confusion that we've seen is, and we talked about this on the beginning of the call, is the bifurcation between existing assets and new construction opportunities. Now, this is really tailored to new construction. And I think a lot of the confusion that's been in the marketplace is that this is available for just deals that are available in those zones. And so we haven't seen, it doesn't really affect much in the way of existing buildings and existing prices of assets that are selling. And on new construction, it's pretty hard without some of the details that we've gotten and the time factor of how long it takes in terms of going through the development process to kind of really truly know kind of what the value impact will be yet. But, you know, the quickest place that we'd probably see it would be in existing asset sales, and it really doesn't have much of an impact on existing asset sales unless it's, you know, a huge transformational rehab, and we haven't seen that yet.
And just for the audience's benefit, the reason it doesn't have a big issue on, or as, hasn't had as material of an issue on acquisitions is a very heavy rehab requirement that effectively is equal to 100% of the purchase price, if I have that correctly?
That is correct. It either has to be new construction in the sense that its original use begins after December 31st, 2017 in an opportunity zone, or it's substantially improved, which is 100% of the basis in the property, which is likely acquisition cost.
Great, thank you. Well, let's move along a little bit then. I have a property that's partially in an opportunity zone. What are the chances that I get it qualified as an opportunity zone property? Do you want to volunteer to take that one?
Well, I think the technical questions, and there's clearly not an answer here, because it's a surprise given all that we've talked about so far. The property to be eligible has to be in an opportunity zone. So the question becomes, what would the rule be on a property that straddles an opportunity zone, and how would you go about structuring it? There's a number of thoughts that folks have. One would be there's a rule that not all, if you're investing in an opportunity zone business, you only have to have substantially all your property be in an opportunity zone. So depending on how much of the property is outside the zone, you may meet the substantially all test. We're not sure what that percentage test is. We expect it to be somewhere between 70 and 85% of a business's tangible property would need to be qualifying opportunities on business property to meet the test. So to answer your question, I think is either A, it has to be partially, not very much can be outside the zone, or B, maybe there's something you could do through a condo process to where you would get the benefits just on the portion that's in the zone.
Any other thoughts on that? All righty. So the next question, which I think it's I'd like to get both the perspective of Jeff Jaeger at Standard Companies and then obviously the legal and accounting people. But, you know, as this mechanism is intended, as Mike mentioned, is predominantly focused on new construction opportunities, you know, going to the question, taking entitlement risk on investment opportunities, particularly new construction, is higher than an acquisition rehab. What happens if the entitlement process takes longer than what is expected in the development? How does it impact the opportunity zone investment? And, you know, maybe again, Jeff and or Mike, to get your perspectives on this.
Sure. I think one of the things, and Mike, you can probably speak to this and you know, kind of more precise numbers on the return calculations that you guys have done. But really kind of the way we've really been focused on, you know, it's a declining benefit, especially in the deferral. So there's a hard date certain in which the tax deferral gets picked up per the code. So on entitlement opportunities, we've been really focused on if you're in, you know, certain zones that you know may be more difficult to develop than others, you have a risk that the amount of benefit that you're receiving from the deferral, you know, declines depending on whether it may take you, you know, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years to enter into that zone. And then secondly, there, you know, really aren't details yet as to how to manage cash in the meantime. So as you're kind of raising capital to go into these zones, you know, to the extent that you are taking down a piece of land, you know, spending money on the entitlements, I think, you know, most of that, I think most people would agree, you know, qualifies. You know, the question is as you continue to certify these economic opportunity zone investments and that they're, you know, in qualified property, you know, there's a big question outstanding of, you know, the cash that you've developed from the capital gains and where that's sitting while you go through this entitlement process. And maybe, Mike, you can kind of speak to, you know, kind of where that stands and you know, kind of the managing of that, because I think that's a big thing that we've been looking at, you know, from the entitlement process as you go through, and if a deal takes 3 to 5 years, you know, how you look to kind of manage that balance.
I think that's there's a couple of number of questions kind of embedded in there. One is how quickly an opportunity fund has to invest cash that it receives from investors. And absent guidance from Treasury, there are two measurement dates. There's a six-month date and a one-year date. And for a calendar year, that would be June 30th and December 31st. Albeit for a new fund, we think the better interpretation is you have 6 months from the date the new fund started to initially invest the capital. And your measurement dates are, so if your measurement dates are June 30th and December 31st, right now as it stands, if you receive cash on June 30th and you have a full calendar year with your fund, you'd have to have invested that cash, at least 90% of it, in qualifying property in order to be meet the test, or at least virtually do that, and then by the end of the year, invest even more so that your average for the year is 90%. We do expect Treasury to issue guidance to allow some sort of a grace period, and they've allowed a similar grace period for the new market tax credit program. There's a couple of ways in which Treasury could do it, either through a reasonable cause exception to the penalty, or they could do it through a working capital provision that you would use through investing in a qualified opportunity zone business. So that is one of the major areas of sort of unanswered questions in terms of how to manage the cash of the opportunity fund and get it into the business now quickly. And that plays into raising capital. How quickly can you raise capital, given that you have this issue of using the cash? And, you know, there's a number of different approaches that folks are taking to that. In terms of the timing, this is a incentive that perishes over time in the sense that right now it's a deferral to 2026. So as you get closer to 2026, the value of that tax deferral declines. Plus, you get a step up in basis of 10%, an additional 5% for holding it 5 and 7 years. That step up in basis, if you get within 7 years, once you get past 2019, you'll be within 7 years of the income recognition date. So the 7-year hold benefit isn't very significant value at all. So if you wait till 2020 to invest, some of the benefits will have perished. If you wait 2 more years, then the 5-year benefits will perish. And then you'll be left with a third benefit, which is the benefit of having no tax on additional gains from the fund. So it's a perishable incentive. But I would note that when we run numbers, and we just assume for a moment that you have a 6% after-tax rate of return on your investment through appreciation over a 10-year period, that 6% after-tax rate of return, if you waited until just before the end to make the investment so you get no benefit from the deferral and no benefit from the step-ups, you would still go from a 6% to about a 7.5% to 8% after-tax rate of return. So that avoidance of gain is really powerful. And so we estimate roughly half the value of the subsidy is that deferral of gain, and then the other half is deferral of the gain and the 15% exclusion of gain.
Hey, Mike, your discussion about gain is actually a really good segue into our next question, which is a collection of questions. And again, your perspective, Lisa's perspective, everybody's perspective would be important because it's, I think this is a just essential to how people might look at implementing this. But, you know, is the qualified opportunity zone fund investment limited to previously realized gains? Does all of the investment or gain, or does all of the investment have to be gain? Can gains be mixed or pooled? And then I think Jeff talked a little bit about the management of cash in a opportunity zone fund, but if we could talk a little bit more about
right.
those questions relative to gain.
So the first question is what types of gains are eligible to invest in a qualified opportunity fund and get the benefit of the deferral? The statute itself says gains. Earlier drafts of the statute said capital gains, And then the statute itself was changed to simply say gain before it was enacted. However, there are some titles within the statute, which aren't supposed to be given any significance, that say capital gain. So there are some references to capital gain in the statute, but not the statute itself. However, the conference report does reference capital gains. I think the general thinking is that capital gains are likely going to be, Treasury is likely to come out and say that it's capital gains that are eligible for this benefit, but that's not free of doubt. And like I said, the statute says gains, so it could be that Treasury comes back and says, no, it's more than capital gains, it's other types of gains. Also, in the context of capital gains, one of the questions comes up, you know, if you have rental real estate and you're selling rental real estate, whether or not it qualifies as a capital gain or not depends on a variety of factors. So it's unclear to what extent sales of rental real estate and to what extent they qualify to be rolled in. So there's some complexities there from an interpretation question. With that said, once you realize that you have some gains, I think the general thinking is that you don't have to invest all the gains. You could invest a portion of your gains, and simply up to the amount of the gains that you have, you could invest in the fund. And if you had capital gains and capital losses, you could invest the capital gains, and even though you don't have to invest the net capital gains or losses, you can invest gross capital gains in the funds. And I would emphasize, as you noted, Mark, that the benefit of the deferral, particularly the 10-year benefit, but all the benefits of the opportunity zone investing only come if you roll in gains into the investment, into the qualified opportunity fund. A qualified opportunity fund could have both rolled over or deferred gains invested as well as, you know, fresh cash, not attributable to gains. However, in that circumstance, the investors in the qualified opportunity fund that are investing cash and not deferring gain will not get any of the benefits that the opportunity fund will generate for those that are deferring gain in exchange for their investment.
And so, I'm sorry, Mike, I might have missed it, but what about pooling gains or mixing gains?
Well, I think in terms of there's nothing, you could have gains from multiple investments that could all be aggregated together to invest in an opportunity fund, as best as we understand the rules.
Great, thank you. All righty. So the next question I'm going to pose to John Hepplett, and we've talked a lot about ambiguity, and so I'm going to ad-lib a little bit on the question. Ambiguity can cause a bifurcation in investors. Ambiguity could cause an opportunity for early adapters. It could cause institutional investors perhaps to be slow to come into the market. But John, if we could maybe have you talk a little bit about, you know, given the ambiguity and where we are today, how do you see bank and investors' interests at the institutional level? And going back to talking about CRA and whether CRA is going to further drive institutional investment in some substantial way.
Sure. I guess a couple of big picture perspectives. One is that the tax credit market has historically had at times non-CRA investors and has had CRA investors. And right now, for various reasons, both, you know, bank-specific reasons and interest rate, economic reasons, tax reasons, it is predominantly a CRA market. What that means to me is that in at least many markets, most markets by dollar volume, I guess, the CRA capital has driven out the pure economic investors. We are, despite having CRA obligations, though, we are banks, we have bottom lines, we have capital return expectations, and to do this business in size, it has to have economic returns. So there's this ongoing balance of economic motivated investment, CRA motivated investment. By introducing opportunity funds, there is a new tool to both enhance possibly returns and enhance capital into the projects that we work on. So I think initially it's, you know, there will be a lot of uncertainty. Banks in particular, every investor dislikes uncertainty. Banks in particular dislike uncertainty. So although we're gunned up to make a difference here, we may be, as an industry, slightly slower adopters than more nimble entities, private individuals. You know, maybe I've heard of people with short-term capital gains that obviously this is an even better vehicle to recycle short-term capital gains for an individual if they can do that. So it's not a complete answer, but I think that the market will move this way. I think the structure around QOFs will solidify such that a bank will be uncompetitive if they don't use a qualified opportunity fund for certain projects. And that will spur adoption. There's obviously a strong alignment of affordable housing development and QOFs or OZs. A lot of a disproportionate number of affordable housing developments are in opportunity zones. So it's something that can't be ignored. So summary is a little bit slow to adopt, sadly, but, you know, true because of conservatism. We want all these things to be ironed out. And then eventual need to adopt to be competitive in the market.
Thank you, John. I'm curious, Jeff Jaeger and Lisa Brill, you know, what you guys have seen. I know you're each out in the market in a different way, but what have people seen or experienced relative to the, you know, the institutional investor here versus the captive or proprietary investor?
I'm happy to start with that. I mean, you know, we've been seeing a number of developers who aren't necessarily the ones who have the gain to invest, who have opportunities and are looking for institutional investors. And those deals we're expecting to see having them look more like, you know, a typical real estate joint venture or club deal with respect to the development or improvement of real estate. Certainly there are, you know, people we've spoken with who have property already, and then it becomes a little tricky depending on whether they acquired the property, if that will count as qualified opportunity zone property. And then, you know, certainly you have people who might have gain and go out and create captives, which I think is something that, you know, people are, you know, are starting to see as well. So certainly we're seeing interest in all of those. You know, people who already have properties figuring out how to get the benefit of this program if it's still available for them. And certainly developers who are out there speaking to brokers and speaking to people to find investors who might have gain in order to put properties they've identified to use.
Jeff,
yeah,
you,
I think, I was going to step in, Mark. I mean, I think that on the institutional side, I think the lack of clarity, as John alluded to, has been challenging. I think there, you know, obviously a lot of questions. I think the biggest interest that we've seen is really, you know, from the, I would say kind of quasi-institutional family office sector, in which, you know, we've seen a lot of interest, on the capital side of looking into whether or not this is something that might be available to them. I think there's a lot of game that's sitting on the sideline that you know, maybe it's whether it's in tech companies or you know, kind of various other holdings that people have, and they're looking whether this is a strategy to move into this space. But I think, you know, kind of until we get further details, I think it's you know, it's been difficult you know, for those people to make the move to move into the captive or kind of whatever the other mechanism might be, not knowing, you know, kind of some of the rules in terms of how some of these things are going to get managed. But I think that there's certainly, I would say that the level of interest on the high net worth side has been higher than we've seen on the institutional side. And we'd expect that the institutional investment would probably be a, you know, kind of second wave once some of the details are figured out, and the early adopters would be probably in the high net worth space of individuals that are subject to the capital gains.
And then, Mark, I would just add that in terms of the institutional investors, one of the gating questions is you have to have capital gains, or I should say, one of the gating questions is we have to know what types of gains are eligible, and if it turns out to be only capital gains, then an institution has to identify how much they have in capital gains and how predictable their capital gains are. And then within the institution, they have to identify how they're going to use those capital gains within an opportunity fund, opportunity zone investing context, which divisions within the group. So our experience is a lot of institutions are still trying to sort through what gains they might have that could be eligible for investing and where within the institution they might seek to dispose or invest in opportunity funds. So I agree with Jeff that, you know, we're definitely seeing a lot more on the family office type as more earlier type adopters, but I certainly expect there to be a wave of the institutional as we start to get more guidance on some of these gating questions.
Great. Thank you, guys. That's complete. Thank you. So we've talked about, again, the primary use of this is, new construction. We've talked about, the entitlement risk. But, I'll throw this open to whoever wants to take it. But can you basically land bank in an opportunity zone, and what are the implications of it?
I think, Mark, I can step in as something, on the development side that we've, been looking at. I think there's certainly, under the guidance, for the economic opportunity zone investments, I think you certainly don't seem, it's really tailored to building new construction. So you have to deliver a building, within the time periods are set aside in the guidance, and obviously we're expecting some more rules to come out for particular projects and maybe funds that are set aside, for particular developments, as Mike was alluding to. But I think that we've certainly been, kind of looking at different opportunities of I think that there's definitely people that are exploring finding sites and opportunities within economic opportunity zones that will probably be more valuable over time as, you get entitlements and they become kind of more realized opportunities. But that, we've been looking at that without necessarily opportunity zone capital, but an opportunity to be able to tie up for the use of opportunity zone capital once it becomes something that would be, in a form that can get used in an economic opportunity zone fund.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think a traditional land banking over a sort of a long-term basis, I don't think is very consistent with the overall purpose of the statute, so that is a challenge. However, some forms of shorter-term indirect land banking, I think, can be arranged subject to, certain issues being clarified by Treasury.
Great. Thank you. I'm going to go to our last curated question. We have some additional questions if time permits, but I want to make sure that we leave a little bit of time for audience Q&A, and we're within about a 15-minute window of what we talked about. So just last question is, some states expect to follow federal exclusions, some don't. How does this change the rate of return in different states and level of interest from investors? And I don't know if that's maybe John, Jeff, Lisa, Mike question for all of you, I guess.
We've definitely seen a difference in level of interest depending on where the taxpayers are located. And Mike, and Lisa, maybe you guys can speak to more of the specifics on the different states, but it's certainly a nuance because this is a federal statute and, we're talking about federal tax, and the state tax has become, kind of a big topic of discussion, for us as we've been looking at where different projects are at and where different investors might be located.
Yeah, same on the bank side. Obviously, we buy state credits. There are state historics and other state tax credit programs. So to the extent there's economic value there, the industry would obviously take advantage of that. It would be part of the calculus.
We've certainly seen people focused on it, but I haven't seen it move the needle one direction or another in terms of overall interest. Clearly right now the people I've spoken to are focused on the federal exclusion and are sort of waiting to see what happens on the state level, but that hasn't tipped the needle one way or another as to what anyone's going to do. Certainly interest has remained high with the information we have.
Yeah, Lisa, it's been the same for us in terms of not tipping the scale. They're interested in knowing whether or not a particular state does or doesn't qualify if they have an income tax, but it hasn't tipped the scale. I'd say the one area where it's probably the most relevant is when you're evaluating a like-kind exchange or not, because then a like-kind exchange might be recognized by that state, but the opportunity zone may not, in which case you may look at that and say, well, there we see that being more relevant in trying to decide do I engage in a like-kind exchange or not. Other than that, it's more that would be an extra benefit and be more encouragement, which I think the designers of the opportunity zone incentive would like to see more states following the federal exclusion to provide additional incentives to layer on top of the opportunity zone incentive, so you do have meaningful capital going into these areas in transforming ways.
And to make sure my comments were clear, to clarify, it would not be part of our economic calculation until the program was in place and the uncertainties resolved around it, much like the federal program. So it's an as if when it becomes a yes.
Yeah, we are seeing definitely on the deal side, to the extent there's talk of certain states that are following the federal exclusion, I think we're seeing a level of interest, at least on developers, a little that are looking on a national basis, focusing a little bit more on not in a huge way, but definitely a little bit more on certain states that they think might be following the federal guidelines in which there's a full exclusion on both sides.
Great. Well, guys, I'm going to move to audience Q&A. So, Charlene, if you could advance to the next slide, and then Leanne, if you want to come back on and share with the audience how to unmute their phone and ask a question.
And as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, please press star 1 to ask a question over the phone lines.
And I'm going to tee up one of the questions we got via email during the presentation while we're waiting for a queue on the phone. The question is, hey, we set up a partnership to undertake a LIHTC project prior to the creation of Opportunity Zones. The subject property ended up being located within an Opportunity Zone. All of the approvals are in place in the name of the existing partnership. Can this existing partnership be set up as a qualified opportunity fund, or do the general partner and limited partner have to be the QOFs?
I'm happy to tackle that one. There are a number of questions, as you can imagine. One of the first threshold questions is, could the partnership itself be a qualified opportunity fund, or could it be a qualified opportunity zone partnership interest or qualified opportunity zone business? So the first question is, could it be one or the other? Theoretically, depending upon the underlying facts, it could qualify as either a qualified opportunity fund or it could be qualified opportunity zone business property, what you're going to build, such that this partnership could elect to be a qualified opportunity fund. So there's a couple of different structuring choices there. In terms of whether or not the property itself would qualify as qualified opportunity zone business property, which is the gating question, you'd have to first look and see if the property was acquired after December 31st, 2017. To the extent that it wasn't, then you'd have to look at how much of the property was acquired before. And even if some of the property was acquired before, it could potentially still qualify. And then you could march forward and do your building and be an eligible sort of investment. To the extent that too much of the property was acquired before December 31st or before January 1st, 2018, then you may would then have to, if you were going to move forward with it being an eligible investment, likely have to make a transfer, and there are very restrictive related party rules in order for it to be eligible. So that's a general overview. There's a lot of embedded assumptions and assumptions of knowledge as well in my answer. Others may want to further expand or clarify particular points.
All righty. Well, unless people have anything to add, well, maybe, Leanne, do you have anybody queued up on the phone?
And we do have a few questions in the queue. We'll move to our first phone question.
Hi, it's Liz Tracy, and I was wondering about the affirmatively furthering fair housing rule, which I know is not being enforced today, but if it were to be, again, would that impact how many or just the favorability of doing a LIHTC deal in an opportunity zone, given it's a low, typically a low-income census tract?
Yeah, this is Mike Novogradic. I'm not a fair housing attorney, and I don't play one on TV either. Generally, the thought is that clearly this is driving capital in these areas. It does have the potential to have an impact, and I haven't heard from fair housing attorneys yet as to how they think it's going to have an impact. It's certainly from a state housing agency perspective in terms of then allocating tax credits within a variety of areas. A lot of us know of high opportunity areas, which are completely, the opposite of what we're talking about in terms of opportunity zones. So there definitely is some tension there, and it's something that, probably needs to get worked out, certainly has to get worked out in terms of other funding sources like low-income housing tax allocations, how it might need to get sort of worked out from a pure Internal Revenue Code perspective. I'll have to leave to others to address.
All right, well, I'm going to take the prerogative to ask a question that came in over email, but it's one that I think I've asked before, and I'm not sure I'm clear on, but I know probably a lot of people in the audience are interested in this. And this goes to the basically the acquisition basis in an if this were to be used for an acquisition, what's included in the acquisition basis, which then triggers the rehab requirement, and specifically, is land included in acquisition basis?
So I think the answer is likely yes. The statute simply says you have to spend an amount of money, an amount equal to the adjusted basis of the property at the beginning of your 30-month period. And the question becomes, what's the property? And the property likely is the land and any existing building on the land that you're improving. If you didn't include the value of the land, then you get into a technical question of, if you can't include the value of the land for this test, then that probably means the land isn't qualifying property, such that you could potentially fail the test in its entirety. So I think the answer that we're expecting to see is land and building are treated, acquisition cost of land and building are what you need to spend, the acquisition cost of them, in substantial improvements in order to be eligible.
And Mike, this is Liz. I think that's certainly one of those questions where everyone's hoping for a little more guidance to confirm what you just said, but that's certainly the interpretation that people are going with.
So this is just a follow-on question, I think, to that, which is, again, over email. Is there really a prohibition on a qualified investment for a qualified zone fund for a 4% rehab if the rehab is $40,000 per unit and the purchase price is $60,000 per unit? Any leeway in the rehab relative to acquisition price? I think from what you've just described, the answer is, with what we know now, no. Correct, Mike?
Correct.
Okay. And I keep holding out hope that I know, at least in bond transactions, when they've come to rehab tax-exempt tests for the rehab expenditure, I know in the bond world they have backed out land, but that certainly doesn't appear to exist today. So I think, as you've said, land is included in acquisition basis. Leanne,
I will just note that there has been some commentary about how severely limiting it is, the subsidy is with respect to the incentive is with respect to existing businesses. And there are some that have been trying to push for Treasury providing some regulatory relief or even going any statutory relief so there's more flexibility with existing businesses like an existing rental property that you're doing an rehab on. So your answer, I think the answer is correct right now. It's likely no, but just know there's a lot of thought and discussion going on as to ways to allow something like that to be feasible.
Leanne, do you have another caller?
And we'll move to our next phone question. And caller, your line is open. You may have us on mute.
Oh, sorry about that. If we are in the process of doing a like-kind exchange, but we think we're going to fail and not be able to close within the 180 days, are we still able to invest in a qualified opportunity zone, or is the 180 days basically over at that point, or do we have an additional 180 days?
Yeah,
great
question.
Jeff,
excellent question.
Go ahead, Jeff. I was just going to say we've actually been looking at that question in particular, and I, Mike, you probably can speak to the specifics, kind of more, but we have kind of come to the conclusion that, it's a bit tricky because I think you do have 6 months from the date that you've sold the property and, that during that time period or in which you've recognized the capital gains and that cash is tied up with the intermediary if you're looking at doing a 1031 exchange. So to the extent that, the exchange fails, there is a bit of trickiness because on the 180th day is when you get, the cash back. And I think theoretically, based on the guidance here, you'd have to be in the Qualified Economic Opportunity Zone fund and at least invested in it. So I think there's some nuance in terms of, how to do that. But it seems like it might be possible, but it's a bit tricky with the handling of cash.
Okay, thank you.
Great question.
Hey, Mark.
Yes.
I know we're coming up on the end. We've had a number of good questions. Thank you, everyone. And we will, to the extent possible, get email responses to those that we haven't highlighted verbally. There were two comments that came in that I meant to mention before worth noting is that deferring the gain, and Mike, Lisa, Jeff, you could correct me if wrong, you are subject to whatever tax rate is in force in 2026 when you've deferred that gain. And so it's notable certainly from the corporate perspective, we're at a 21% now, and there are benefits to the 15% reduction in the deferral from a time perspective, but that benefit could be significantly reduced or eliminated if corporate tax rates were meaningfully higher. And so that's a further consideration for pricing. Similarly, I did mention earlier that, in the extreme example of, maybe I didn't mention, but a corporation with a 2017 gain, if they had set up a qualified opportunity fund, or if, I guess if they still do in the next 10 days, they could defer taxation from last year's 35% rate to whatever the 2026 rate may be, such as 21% or whatever it is at that time. So I think that somebody made a good point, and somebody else implicitly asked it as a question in there. Mike, Lisa, Jeff, anything I missed on that topic?
No, I think that is something to take into account because the only way you could really avoid that first of all, it appears that is the correct interpretation. The gain would be recognized at the tax rate in place in the year that you recognized it, even though there is some seeking Treasury confirmation of that. And then from a planning perspective, if it did turn out that the gains rate was rising or has risen, you could dispose of your investment early, but that would be something you have to assess whether or not the benefits of doing that outweighed, you know, the benefits of not doing that in that future date. It's certainly an important consideration to take into account.
Hey, Mike, is the converse of that also an opportunity where, particularly somebody who might be thinking about this from a captive standpoint, gets a more favorable treatment, not only from the deferral, but say of a lower tax rate at the time they recognize the deferral?
That is correct. The flip side of that is if tax rates, you know, declined, or the taxpayer themselves were in a lower tax rate,
right,
then they would get that benefit of a lower tax rate. I'd also note that to the extent that the investment actually depreciates in value, you don't recognize the full amount of the gain. So the amount of gain you recognize is the lesser of the gain deferred in excess of your basis or the fair market value in excess of your basis. So you don't need to worry about having the asset depreciate in value but still having to pay the full amount of tax on the full amount of gain.
Great. Well, we are we're past our stop time, and I know we got a lot of questions over the internet. And what I'm going to suggest that we do is, as John said, we will endeavor to answer those questions specifically, and then perhaps, Charlene, we could also put just a Q&A along with those answers on a Q&A along with the deck when it gets posted on the website. Again, I think we could probably go another hour with very detailed and very good questions. So I apologize if you asked a question or wanted to ask a question and didn't have the opportunity to do it, but I'm going to respect the time commitment of my panelists and bring this to a close. I want to thank Lisa and Jeff, Mike and John for the knowledge that they shared with us, the time that was spent into coming up with the program. Certainly, I think they all would be happy to, you know, individually talk with you if you have questions. I think as John mentioned as we opened up this, this is a development that I think people focused on after the intense drama of dealing with year-end deals and first quarter deals that it were impacted by the 2017 Act. It's something that obviously more information is still forthcoming. It's in a development stage. I think people would be happy to talk with you about it, and we may very well find ourselves coming back later in the year and giving an update on this with things that we've known. So I'm going to thank my panelists, but also give each and every one of them an opportunity for some parting words. John, I'll start with you. Anything to add?
Nothing. Thank you.
Lisa?
No, just thank you for including me. I think that this is, a really interesting opportunity for investors and developers generally. And, I think they're great questions. And hopefully in the next couple of months, we'll start to have a lot more answers. And we'll be talking about the opportunity funds that are actually out there investing.
Good. Thank you. Jeff?
Yeah, no, thank you for including me, Mark. I think that, you know, as Treasury has really put out the guidance that they want to see this program in effect, as soon as possible, and there is limited guidance, I think it's important that everybody kind of continues the dialogue and that people kind of share, industry information to make sure that, I think to the extent that people are working as a group, I think it will be helpful being able to have guidance that comes out that is reflective of kind of as people are using the program. But thank you, and that's all I have to say.
Yep, thank you. And Mike, last but certainly not least.
Well, thank you. I appreciate, once again, the opportunity to participate. I would just encourage everyone to stay tuned. It's pretty powerful. As we get more guidance from Treasury, we'll start to get some clear paths to ways in which you can most efficiently use this incentive. And I would also just sort of note that as a group, don't expect Congress in some future year to push back that 2026 gain recognition date. I don't see that in the cards. However, I do see as potential in the future, if this is successful in raising a lot of capital, and the Joint Committee on Taxation estimates it'll raise $30 to $40 billion of capital over the next 5 years, that Congress might come back and create a new tranche where you have to invest by 2019, and then the deferral date is not 2026, it's 2028, and you start creating tranches of opportunity zone investing. So I don't look at this as something that's this narrow window of opportunity or it's going to go away. If it's successful, I expect to see Congress create new tranches in the future.
Great. Well, again, I thank you all for your time. We will take the questions that didn't get answered and attempt to answer them to the best of our ability to you individually, and then we'll put some sort of collective Q&A also up on the website. So if you were on hold to ask a question and didn't have the opportunity, email it to askcitycommunitycapital@city.com, and we'll do our best to address it. Be patient, it may be, because we've got people that are traveling across the country today. It may be a day or two for us to get answers back out to you, but we'll certainly endeavor to do that. So with that, thank you for your time today, and look forward to talking to you on our next City Community Capital Market Insights. Thank you.
And that does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.